From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The confirmation process for Judge Brett Kavanaugh is moving forward. That's the message from the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. However, there's still great uncertainty about what comes next. Bay Area Professor Christine Blasey Ford's been given a deadline of tomorrow morning to decide whether she'll testify before the committee about an alleged sexual assault by Kavanaugh. We'll have all the latest right after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA with attendance only twice per term. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Coming up, the U.S. Department of Education's embracing a State Department view that questioning Israel's right to exist is inherently anti-Semitic. Criticism of Israel being a specifically Jewish state is often heard on college campuses, but is that religious discrimination? We'll debate that later this hour. First, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Charles Grassley says the confirmation process for Judge Brett Kavanaugh will move forward. Grassley's given Kavanaugh accuser Christine Blasey Ford until tomorrow morning to decide if she'll testify before the committee. Professor Blasey Ford claims Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her when they were both in high school. But Blasey Ford and Senate Democrats are resisting having her testify. They want Kavanaugh's background check reopened by the FBI before the professor details her allegation to the committee. If she holds to her demand, what will the Judiciary Committee do with us? With the latest details, Los Angeles Times congressional reporter Sarah Weil. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So can you, first of all, just sort of give us the temperature on Capitol Hill, just sort of what the mood is today?
There seems to be a lot of contention, as you would imagine. Neither the House nor the Senate is in session right now. But there are a lot of protesters on Capitol Hill. We've seen dozens of arrests. People blocking the offices of moderate or more vulnerable senators who might be convinced to vote no on Kavanaugh.
And we heard, speaking of senators who've come out with their position, Claire McCaskill of Missouri, the Democrat, has taken her stand that she will not be voting for Kavanaugh's confirmation.
Yes, she did, although she did say that that was because of his position on dark money. She said it had nothing to do with the most recent allegations, which everyone thought was kind of interesting.
So here we are with this deadline of tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock. I assume that's Eastern time. Mm-hmm. So that's 7 Pacific. And as Grassley said, what his plan is, if she does not agree to speak to the committee, will they go forward Monday with just Kavanaugh talking about the alleged incident?
Well, there seems to be a lot of discussion ongoing right now about that. If she chooses to not attend or perhaps wants to do it in a closed session, they have to look at the wisdom of having Kavanaugh speak on his own, and that potentially opens a chance for other embarrassing questions into his personal life that perhaps weren't answered already. So I'm sure they want to weigh that a little bit of whether it's worth reopening versus, giving him a chance to defend himself publicly.
Do we know if there are investigators hired by Republicans or Democrats who are looking into the allegation and trying to talk with people? Aside from an FBI investigation, are the parties looking at this themselves?
Yes. On the Senate Judiciary Committee, both sides have they're called staff investigators. They're tasked with reviewing FBI reports and making some follow-up calls. And they are definitely reaching out to Blasey Ford and to some of the other people that she's mentioned to, try to, interview them and ask some questions so that they can be prepared for Monday. The problem is these are, these are partisan employees. Their boss is the senator. So it's not necessarily an impartial investigation. I've spoken with several former staff members on the committee who say that's their biggest concern, is that the questioning is going to be done in a way to try to get a specific result.
Well, and the other factor is these staff investigators, they typically comb documents, right? They don't do background investigations. They don't necessarily interview people to try and determine credibility, right?
Exactly. And to be fair, the FBI wouldn't be determining credibility either. The FBI would be compiling information from various sources and then presenting that information to senators. The senators would make a determination of the credibility.
All right. And again, Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee, they're holding to the plan that they don't want to delay the proceedings. So they're planning one way or another to do a vote on the Kavanaugh nomination?
We don't know that for sure yet, but all signs do seem to be pointing that direction. You get a real sense up here that they want to move forward as quickly as possible. The original goal was to have Kavanaugh approved and on the bench by the first day of the court session this year, which is in early October. There's got to be a little bit of concern for Republicans that, you know, there's always a chance that they could lose the Senate in this upcoming election. And so they've got to be keeping an eye on that as well.
We're talking with the LA Times congressional reporter Sarah Weyer with us from D.C. talking about the latest developments. I was just reading that there are all kinds of rumors flying back and forth about the allegation and Kavanaugh. And I'm just curious, you as a reporter, how much exposure do you have to all this sort of, rumor mill that's going on in D.C.?
We're definitely being inundated and you can see that a lot of that's not appearing in the Times yet because we're doing our due diligence and double and triple checking everything we're hearing. It's always the problem with incidents like this, that there's so much disparate information coming at you. It's difficult to know what's true and what's not. And that's one of the reasons that the senators have asked that Ford and Kavanaugh be interviewed under oath publicly. Lying to Congress is a federal crime.
Even if both of them do it and both certainly have plenty of people who come forward and vouch for their credibility and their character, that's just going to leave senators with, you know, the competing allegation and denial of it and two people who are held in high regard. And you're just kind of left with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think both sides really want to. They think that this hearing could dictate where things go from here. And so you definitely see that Democrats and Republicans are looking for different pieces of information to come out of this.
All right. Sarah, thank you so much. Really appreciate your taking time. I know it's a very busy day for you as all these matters are, of course, coming to a head with tomorrow's deadline for the Senate Judiciary Committee. Sarah Weyer, congressional reporter for the Los Angeles Times, joining us on Air Talk. The federal government reopening an investigation into what's alleged to be an anti-Semitic incident at New Jersey's Rutgers University. The incident goes back to 2011. Jewish students say that they and pro-Israel students were the only ones charged a fee to attend an on-campus event on Israeli-Palestinian relations. The Zionist Organization of America filed a complaint against Rutgers, claiming the fee was discriminatory. And then in 2014, the Obama administration cleared Rutgers of discriminatory conduct, closed the case. But then, recently, the Zionist group filed an appeal of the federal government decision. Last week, the Department of Education announced it would revive the investigation and look at whether a hostile environment exists at the university. Central to that reexamination is the Department of Education citing a definition of anti-Semitism that encompasses expressions of anti-Israel sentiment and denial of the right of Israel to exist as a specifically Jewish state. Pro-Palestinian groups have denounced the move, saying that criticizing Israel's actions or its right to be a specifically Jewish state is not anti-Semitic. We're going to take a look at that issue over the course of this next segment of Air Talk. And joining me in conversation, first of all, from Syracuse University, Associate Associate Professor of Political Science, Miriam Ellman. Professor, thank you for joining us again. First of all, let's talk about this State Department definition that the Education Department is citing. What does it specifically say about Zionism and criticism of Israel and Zionism?
Sure. Well, thanks again, Larry, for having me on the show. And let me just start by saying that, you know, just like any country on the planet, Israel is, of course, you know, subject to having its laws, its policies, its leadership criticized, you know, even if those criticisms are made very vehemently. And the State Department definition, along with the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition, which have been adopted by the EU, Canada, the U.S. State Department, and the majority of organized Jewish community worldwide, you know, all these definitions, the IHRA and the State Department definition, recognize that there is, of course, legitimate criticism of Israel that can't be subjected to any censorship on campus. But what the State Department definition does and what the IHRA definition does, which Ken Marcus and the OCR will now use to consider whether hostile environments for Jews exist on campuses, that it rests really on longstanding consensus about new forms of anti-Semitism, which have been popularized by the famous Soviet prisoner of conscience, Natan Sharansky, and it's kind of called the three Ds, so demonization of Israel, delegitimization of Israel, and applying double standards of Israel and behavior that's not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation. And we also know that, you know, there are instances when anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism do conflate, right? So there is such a thing as anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionist expression. So anti-Zionism tends to become anti-Semitism when it incorporates the tropes and the canards about Jewish power and conspiratorial Jewish thinking that are classically made about the pariah Jew and then applies it to the pariah Jewish state. And we are seeing that kind of expression more and more on our American campuses today, unfortunately.
And let me just say, I think, you know, all of us would likely agree with the idea that those sorts of tropes that you describe of conspiratorial Jews and such things, that definitely comes under anti-Semitism. But the other three prongs that you mentioned, let's take delegitimization. Can't someone believe that it's wrong for Israel to be a Jewish state, for there to be a specifically religious state of Israel, and not be anti-Semitic?
Well, one of the really nice things about the IHRA and the State Department definitions is it recognizes that Judaism isn't just a set of religious practices, that Jews actually are a people. That's not surprising to Jews, but a lot of people don't realize that Jews self-define as an ethnic group. And so this new, you know, this definition and allowing the Office of Civil Rights to include Jews within the Title VI definition of groups protected based on ethnicity is actually very consistent with the way Jews self-define. So, you know, upwards of 95% of Jews across the planet historically and in contemporary times, you know, they self-identify as Zionists. And so when you say that, you know, Jews as a people are not allowed to self-determination or that Israel should not exist, you know, and you deny the Jewish people that right, even as you support and champion that right for the Palestinian people or any other people on the planet, you know, which is absolutely something that should be supported, but you deny it and you single out only the Jewish people, you know, we have a term for that kind of bigotry, that kind of singling out of the Jew, and we call it anti-Semitism.
Let me ask also about double standards, because I think you could argue that the United States is a country that's criticized with double standards all the time and held often to a higher standard than other countries are. How is that inherently discriminatory, maybe unfair, to hold Israel to the kind of standard that you're talking about? But how is that discriminatory?
I guess, you know, one of the things that I tend to look at is, you know, to see whether these tropes of Jewish power and conspiracy are, you know, feeding into a virulently anti-Zionist discourse. So, you know, when Israel is, or Israelis, you know, or Israeli leaders are, you know, vilified as Nazis, and we call that Holocaust inversion. There's a large literature on this today. It's not Holocaust denial, but it's sort of applying, you know, this sort of critique that you probably wouldn't apply to other countries or other, you know, other governments, even those that are, you know, very abusive to their citizenry, right, and to citizens of other countries. And yet, you know, you're only applying this sort of category of a Nazi vilification to Israelis. I think that counts, but
okay.
It's a case-by-case basis, Larry. And the important thing to really realize is that when it comes to, you know, anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionist expression, this is speech. And the best way to deal with bad speech and with hate speech is with better speech. And so what it behooves administrations, it behooves campus faculty, and even other student groups and donors and alumni to stand up and be counted and say, you know, we condemn the attacks on Jewish identity and this kind of bigotry.
Cool.
And the thing is, what we have to differentiate is the speech from the harassing and intimidating behavior.
Okay. Please hold that thought, because I do need to break. Syracuse University Associate Professor of Political Science Miriam Ellman with us. Coming up, we're going to hear from the Jewish Voice for Peace organization, and we're going to talk with a member of the group Students for Justice in Palestine, which is based at UCLA. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Is anti-Zionism criticizing the existence of Israel as a specifically Jewish state? Is that inherently anti-Semitic? This gets at the issue of harassment versus free speech versus political speech. And we're talking with three different guests sharing their perspective. We just heard from Professor Miriam Ellman of Syracuse University defending the State Department. She said the EU's also adopted this statement, which looks at the three Ds: demonization of Israel, delegitimization of Israel, and a double standard for criticism of Israel. Also joining us is Esty Chandler, founding member of the LA chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, a national organization that is critical of Israel's practices in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. Thank you very much, Esty, for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
What's your view of this definition of anti-Semitism?
Well, anti-Semitism is a serious phenomenon that must be meaningfully addressed and opposed. These efforts to redefine anti-Semitism, however, to silence criticism of Israel, actually work against those efforts by misclassifying a broad range of criticism of Israel as inherently anti-Semitic. It threatens important political speech activities, which are often in violation of the First Amendment. This definition is actually a manifestation of a political project led by Kenneth Marcus, which is attempting to expand the traditional definition, as we know it, of anti-Semitism to include criticism of Israel. And the definition is so broadly drawn and the examples are so vague that any speech critical of Israel or supportive of Palestinian rights could conceivably fall within it. In fact, if U.S. government entities adopt and apply this overbroad redefinition of anti-Semitism in order to censor political viewpoints critical of Israel, they would likely be violating the First Amendment. Our Constitution protects political speech activities from government interference in order to ensure that who would protest government policies can speak their mind without fear of retribution.
But it sounds like the State Department already has this standard. And according to Professor Ellman, the EU, there are other entities that already use this. So do you already see this as problematic, even separate from university campuses?
Yes. In fact, you know, it was attempted in California. And if it was applied, because it is not a legally binding definition, and obviously if it was tried to be applied as such, then you would be violating our constitutional rights to free speech.
Okay. And so that's what you see using this standard on a university campus, that it is a First Amendment infringement.
Absolutely.
Let me go back to you, Professor Ellman. Your response to this standard being so broad, it infringes free speech.
I completely disagree. It doesn't at all chill constitutionally protected free speech. What it does is it puts universities on notice that they can't dismiss or tolerate discriminatory conduct under the guise of simply facilitating debate about Israel. So that harassing or intimidating Jewish students, as happened allegedly in the Rutgers case that's now being reopened, that kind of discrimination against Jewish students simply cannot be justified by labeling it criticism of Israel.
How, though, why would you need this definition of anti-Semitism to label as harassment? So let's say that you have, Jewish students who are shouted down, or that they, because of their religion, are barred entry to some sort of an event on campus. Wouldn't you still be able to use anti-harassment or anti-discrimination policy to stop that kind of conduct?
I think that the definition is helpful, and again, it would be on a case-by-case basis. So this is basically, we don't know how the Rutgers case, now that it's being revisited, you know, what will happen to it. You know, we don't know where the review will lead. But it's helpful now that we have this, you know, well-accepted, is not a hotly contested definition. It is a widely accepted definition of anti-Semitism, and that we can use it in order to assess, you know, whether discriminatory behavior is rooted in some perception of Jewish ethnic characteristics or Jewish ancestry. You know, as in this Rutgers case, where 150 Zionists are singled out for an admission fee and this discriminatory pricing policy for an event, how did they determine these students were Zionists? Was it based on the fact that they wore a Star of David necklace? Was it a visual assessment, or did they poll all 150 students and ask them what their policies were towards the state of Israel?
Okay, so you're saying this State Department standard would help in the sort of determination of the bias here. Let me bring another voice into the conversation, a member of Students for Justice in Palestine at UCLA, also a board member of the Palestinian Youth Movement, which is an international group of young Palestinians, Omar Zalza. Thank you very much for being with us, Omar. Share with us how you think this definition would play out on a university campus.
Sure. Thank you for having me. Essentially, you know, really enforcing and following through with this definition, which again includes the, you know, the 3Ds portion that was referenced earlier, it's really going to set a very chilling precedent, I think, for, you know, student groups, for various people on campus to be able to advocate for Palestinian rights and to advocate for the Palestinian cause more broadly. I mean, once you have a definition, you know, that so clearly seeks to conflate critique of Israel with anti-Semitism, right, then, of course, it's going to really have a dampening effect on people's ability to engage in the question of, you know, Palestinian freedom, Palestinian rights, so on and so forth. And,
I'd add
that this is actually, I mean, right now, right, this is sort of an escalation. But those of us who've been doing this work on and off campuses for years, this type of development is nothing new. The attempt to conflate critique, you know, of Israeli state policy with anti-Semitism has been something that, you know, opponents of Palestinian rights activism have been pushing for years. So there has been a push even years before this, you know, for universities to formally adopt the State Department definition. The UC Regents initially considered a statement of principles against intolerance that in its first draft said literally anti-Zionism has no place at the UC level.
Yeah, I remember that. We debated that on the program. It's a huge, huge controversy for the UCs. I wanted to ask you, though, do you have off the top of your head a specific example of something that might be a criticism of Israel that you think potentially could run afoul of this State Department definition?
Well, I mean, that's even a complicated question because even the State Department, you know, the State Department itself has a caveat in its own report on this definition that literally says, you know, it doesn't advocate adopting the measures that other governments may have used in countering anti-Semitism because they might run afoul of the First Amendment. So it's even a question of, you know, what is this definition intended to do? What is it intended to serve? And what is it actually supposed to be enforcing? I think the problem is precisely that, you know, there's such a push to make any kind of critique of Israel interchangeable with anti-Semitism to the point that any kind of engagement of the Palestinian cause becomes taboo, becomes off limits. And, you know, to get to this question of the issue of, I guess one of the original questions for this interview was, what do you think of the idea of hostile environments? I mean, definitely when you have issues of, you know, harassment, so on and so forth, that's something that needs to be looked into. But the problem with the concept of a hostile environment is actually that when you take it apart, it's such a broad thing. You know, hostility could very well simply mean political discomfort, somebody who's confronted with views that they may or may not agree with, right? And in that case, you know, universities need to be the place where you're encouraging all kinds of sort of political debate about various issues, even things, you know, that had been considered commonplace maybe in other contexts. Such as, yes, even the question of whether or not, you know, the State of Israel should be engaging in its violations of Palestinian rights.
All right.
Should be existing.
We're talking with Omar Zaza, who is a UCLA student, member of Students for Justice in Palestine, also a board member of the Palestinian Youth Movement, which is an international organization of young Palestinians. I'd like to hear from you, particularly if you're someone who is a college student, you've recently been on campus, you're a professor at a college, administrator, how you see this issue playing out on the ground. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Philip in West Hollywood. Philip, what's your opinion of this?
Yeah, I just wanted to respond directly to Omar and Esty and say that I appreciate the points they're making about there needing to be nuances and complexities in the discussions. But I think something that's important to address is, and as somebody, I recently did my master's at NYU a few years ago, so I've seen these conversations play out myself on campuses. And I think there's a conversation that's not being had, that is that as someone myself who's Jewish, who used to actually be far more vocal about issues that were occurring in Israel, I'm noticing language that's being used by the critical side, where comments are being made like, Jews need to realize or Jews need to understand. And to the point that was made earlier by the woman from Syracuse University, the professor there, there is a problem with language that does bleed into anti-Semitism. And I just want to point out that if a person of color or a person who identifies as Muslim expresses that certain conversations or tropes or language feels offensive, we listen. But I feel there's a double standard where when the Jewish community speaks up, people aren't listening to us and taking us seriously. So I think that sometimes the real issue is that there's issues with language or words we choose or how we approach the conversation with a lack of sensitivity. And that's my main point.
Okay. And so let's give an example. So your view is if someone's critical and says Jews need to fill in the blank, they wouldn't say that about Muslims need to or Palestinians need to or whatever the group is.
I think people lose their manners sometimes, or they just simply don't. They make assumptions or broad generalizations without really thinking or showing respect. And I do think that there's a lot of anger towards Israel, and there may be reason, good reason, because nobody's saying that. I'm not even debating about whether Israel has blood on its hands or not. That's neither here nor there in what I'm trying to discuss.
Yeah, you're talking about the conversation on campus. I get it. Yeah.
And I think there's an underneath feeling of anger about Israel that bleeds into lumping Jews in the diaspora into the conversation. And I think a lot of people in the Jewish community feel underneath is anti-Semitic and object to.
All right. We're going to continue on Air Talk right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I want to thank our guests who joined us for that outstanding segment about the redefinition or adoption of the State Department definition of anti-Semitism. Our thanks to Miriam Ellman of Syracuse University, Esty Chandler of Jewish Voice for Peace, and Omar Zaza of Students for Justice in Palestine and the Palestinian Youth Movement. Well, Metro is looking at coming up with new identifiers for its lines. It's running out of colors. That's the downside of expanding service with so many new lines. You get into so many shades, it can be difficult, particularly with sun fading, to determine what color you're even looking at. So with us to talk about the challenge, we want to hear from you what you think is the best way of identifying the lines. Joining us is Pauletta Toniles, who is Chief Communications Officer at LA Metro. Pauletta, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Thanks very much for having me on.
So how open are you right now in terms of taking suggestions for how to do this?
Well, we're always interested in hearing what the public has to say because, after all, it's all about the people. That's why we've been doing research. We've done some focus groups. And what we have been testing is four basic alternatives that are typically used in the transit industry. That is a color-named system, or a combination where you use colors and then some lines have other names like geographic areas, colors paired with numbers, and colors paired with letters, because research shows that those are really going to be best for the public. So again, it's all about the people. We do want to hear what folks have to say. We are going to be launching some online research soon and also some pop-up events at some of our major rail stations, so people should keep their eye out for that.
All right. I'm kind of a romantic, you know, I love take the A train. And so I kind of like the idea of letters. But I wonder if that's a problem where you've got, you know, many people coming from other countries where, you know, depending on the alphabet, they may be less familiar with the lettering system we would use. Is that a challenge?
Well, it is. That is one of the cons of using letters paired with numbers. But we did learn from our people who are primarily Spanish-speaking writers that they actually prefer the letters with the colors. Again, like I said, there's no perfect situation. Those who come from other countries where they don't use the Roman alphabet, that's where the numbers and the colors come in best. One of our focus groups was with a Korean-speaking audience, and they actually favor the numbers, and that's because they're familiar with the Seoul system, which uses colors and numbers. So, again, people feel various ways about this. We have made no decisions. We are just presenting to the board today at our executive management committee and then next week at the board meeting where we are at this point for people to digest it, and we're then going to be asking the board to direct us to come back in early December with a staff recommendation and then what an implementation plan could look like.
All right. Pauletta, thank you for being with us and telling us where LA Metro is and the timeline for the re-identifying. The current lines, would they be keeping their same, like the Expo line, would it still be called the Expo line, even if it's given a number?
Well, our goal is to have a clear and consistent system across the board. One of the hang-ups with our current system is that it isn't consistent. We have the colors, but then the Expo line is the outlier. And what we learned in focus groups is a lot of people who are not familiar with Metro system don't even understand what the E is for. They think it's for East, like they're traveling.
Oh, yeah.
That it's for Express. So I think we can improve upon even our current system. And if the decision is made to stick with colors, maybe that's across the board. We just stick with colors. But that's, again,
okay.
Cultural Board will give us direction.
Pauletta, thanks so much. Pauletta Tonilas, Chief Communications Officer for LA Metro. So I'd like to hear from you. What's your suggestion for best identifying, and we're not just talking about light rail and subways, we're talking about the bus system too, where of course numbers have been in use very long time. Have you seen a particular city that you think is, you know, does this the best? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jimmy in downtown LA says, I'm colorblind, so I'm happy about the change. Honestly, if they just wrote out in words green or blue line, I'd be okay with that. That's Jimmy in downtown LA. Jimmy, I hadn't thought of that. Appreciate that. Also with us, transportation reporter for the Los Angeles Times, Laura Nelson. Laura, good to have you with us again. How do other public transit agencies deal with this challenge?
Thanks for having me, Larry. There's a blend of options across the U.S. and internationally. Many listeners might be familiar with the New York subway system, which uses a combination of letters, numbers, and colors, which signify kind of what direction or what area of New York the trains are operating in. Chicago uses colors. San Francisco identifies their rail lines by the start and end point of the line. So, for example, if you're on BART, it will tell you that you're on a train headed toward, for example, Warm Springs, or headed toward, San Francisco Airport. So there's a lot of different, and then of course, Paris uses numbers, and a number of other cities across the world use numbers and colors as well. So there's a lot of different options and combinations that Metro has taken a look at.
One of the challenges, I think, with using just, you know, the ultimate destination of the line is, if you're a visitor and you don't know your geography of the city that well, that can be a little confusing. I don't have a better solution, particularly if you're talking about a rail line that doesn't just go, you know, east, west, or north, south. Even with some of our freeways, we have challenges with that. But there is no perfect system, clearly. Again, I'd love to hear from AirTalk listeners. What is your suggestion? What do you think would be the most convenient, most easily identifiable way of differentiating light rail, subway, and bus lines? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Rob in the Mid-Wilshire District, what's your suggestion?
Larry, two words. Naming rights. Can you imagine the Gold Line going to Pasadena being called the AirTalk Larry Mantle Line? Or perhaps, just be fair, the line going to Santa Monica being called the KCRW Madeline Brand Line?
See, Rob, I don't know how I'd feel about that. People complain, man, the Larry Mantle is jammed up again. I hate taking that line. Mantle's such a pain. You see, I don't know, because that would accrue to us, right? But on a serious level, naming rights, I mean, that's an interesting idea. Have you ever seen that done, Rob, with any line where it's actually a sponsored identifier?
Actually in Europe, in Germany.
Really?
I can't tell you. I think it's Bremen, but there are a couple of lines in Germany that are basically have an association with a corporate name. And in Japan as well.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't even, just like you'd name a stadium. Laura, yeah, go ahead.
That was actually discussed in Los Angeles a couple of years ago, and it was very controversial. Metro ended up reversing that policy, but they had proposed allowing companies to sponsor either an entire line or certain stations in the system. And that is in use in Colorado. In Denver, there's a line that's named after a university in town, and it stops at the university, so the name makes logical sense, but the university has underwritten some of the costs of operating that line in other stations and areas as well.
All right. David tweets at AirTalk, if they number them, people will probably continue using the existing names as well as the numbers, just like we do with the freeways, you know, San Diego 405, the Ventura 101, the 10, the Santa Monica, etc. Yeah, I think that that's probably right, David. Although, you know, one of the things we see with the freeways is it's mainly older people who use those historic names. And often for younger people or people who've come more recently to Southern California, they're far more apt to use just the numbers. So over time,
the term expo line, for example, might well fall out of use, and its number would be the way that people would refer to the line should they make that change. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page. AstroGoss says, name them for superheroes. Get the studios to pay for it. The Wonder Woman to West Hollywood. All aboard the Flash Express to downtown. The Superman line to LAX. That's funny. Ed in L.A. says, dude, we're in L.A. Just use celebrity names. The Kobe, the Vin Scully, etc. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. What do you think would be the best identifier for light rail, subways, for bus lines in Los Angeles County? Metro's coming up with new identifiers. They're worried that getting into the subshades of colors is going to make it too difficult for people to know, you know, which blue line you're really talking about, for example. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Brian in Koreatown writes on the AirTalk page, they think the E is for express. Speaking of the expo line, now talk about disappointment. Yeah, the expo isn't quite, not quite an express line. Very true, Brian. We're taking your suggestions. What are the best ways to identify public transit lines in Los Angeles County? Metro is trying to come up with a system for doing that because, you know, of course, they use numbers for the bus lines, and that's been around forever. But on light rail, it's a combination of colors and names, like you've got the Expo line, for example. So the question is, what, you know, what's the best way, and the Crenshaw line that's coming, what's the best way to identify a particular line? Does it need to be consistent? So it's an apple-to-apple comparison. John in South Pasadena says, I think it needs to be a combination of identifying marker, but also a comprehensive app that goes along with it, a Metro app that's well-designed and helps people navigate the system. That's John in South Pasadena, which kind of relates to an issue I was going to bring up with LA Times transportation reporter Laura Nelson. Laura, I was wondering if at some point technology solves this issue, because if everybody is using some sort of a super smart app that navigates you around the system, do names or things like that somehow become less important with time?
That's a good point, Larry. It's definitely true that technology has made it easier to navigate the Metro system. I remember when I moved to LA 10 years ago and I didn't have a smartphone, it was completely baffling to get around on the bus system without GPS, without a map, without knowing where you were trying to go. And now it's much, much easier. That being said, there's a still a significant portion of the Metro riding population in LA that doesn't have access to a smartphone, particularly the lower income. You know, people, retired people, people on disability, people who are not working, who are riding the buses, and they don't have access to that type of information. But if you're a tourist, maybe from out of town, it's certainly become easier to figure out where you need to go and what line will take you there.
Yeah, well, and you've also got reception areas, even for people who do have smartphones, there might be dead spots, and then you're in a jam. You're trying to compare a station you might be at that doesn't have, you know, good coverage. So we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page. Our senior producer, Fiona Ng, coming up with the LA stereotype identifiers. So there'd be the screenwriter line, the surfer line, the valley girl line, the singer-songwriter line. All right, Fiona. Struggling actor. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page. Juliana in Anaheim says, we could use names of flowers, plants, trees, since we're very botanical here. We love our open spaces in California. Why not use those? I'm taking the lilac line. 866 to Iris, 866-893-KPECC. Caroline in Pasadena, how would you identify transit lines in L.A.?
Hi, so I was kind of along the same lines of thinking about nature, but I was thinking about naming lines after, like, native animals to California. So, like, the black bear line, the Garibaldi line, the cougar line, stuff like that.
That's interesting. Yeah, yeah. So you'd use animals. Laura, has that been talked about, something that we think of as iconic Californian?
I love that idea, and I love all these creative ideas. Yeah. Metro is sticking very closely to its rubric of letters, numbers, geographic names, or some combination of those options. Although I'm a big gardener myself, so I do like the idea of native plants.
Yeah, yeah. Norman Lakewood, by the way, Fiona, your idea heavily endorsed by Norma. she likes the idea of L.A. stereotypes. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Tom in Hancock Park is skeptical about running out of colors. He says Chicago uses colors and they have 8 lines. I wonder, though, we're talking about even more lines here in L.A. Laura, plus we have a lot more sun to fade the display of the color here.
Right, we do. So right now, Metro has blue, green, purple, red, orange, gold, and silver, which is kind of the most of the colors on the what we think of as like the Roy G. Biv spectrum. And the issue is that once you start getting into, for example, green versus lime, purple versus lavender, it becomes much more difficult for anyone who has any kind of vision impairment or to see the line without some other kind of alternate identifier. For example, a name, a letter, or a number. There's also some colors that Metro, well, the other reason that they're talking about doing this is because the downtown regional connector subway project will reorganize the way that lines move through Los Angeles. So some of the lines that we think of now, the Expo line, the Blue line, and the Gold line, will end up having different origin and destination points because those lines will be recombined underneath downtown. So to save people the confusion of trying to figure out where their old train used to go and where they need to go now, Metro has decided that, you know, renaming them and kind of rebranding them will be the easiest way for people to understand mm-hmm. the project is going to work.
That makes sense. Dave in Huntington Beach says, I used public transit in Europe. It's extremely helpful to know the number and the last station. So helpfully said. Dave, thanks very much. Justin in Koreatown, what's your suggestion for identifying lines?
I would say geometric shapes like squares or circles or triangles because it's universal. You don't need to know any specific language, and there's really an unlimited amount of shapes to use.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm taking the rhombus line. Laura, has that been discussed?
That's not one of the final options that they're considering, but one of the issues I think that would arise with that idea, which is creative and I like, is that you run out of kind of recognizable shapes after a certain amount of time. Metro is talking about rebranding up to between 16 and 20 lines in the end, and you need something that will give you a wide array of options that are easily recognizable for people.
Bill in the San Gabriel Valley likes the idea of geographic identification. So you'd have the gold line would be Eastern, the red line we just called the Hollywood, purple be called the Westwood line, green be called the LAX line. But of course, the problem is that you've got two ends of a line. So yeah, the green line does terminate right near LAX, but you got the other end of the green line too. So if you're taking it from LAX, I'm not quite sure exactly how helpful that would necessarily be. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Laura, I want to thank you very much for sharing this with us. Kind of, you know, a fun part of public transit to consider all these different options.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. Laura Nelson is transportation reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thomas tweets at AirTalk, emojis. You know, the only problem I have, Thomas, so often I'm looking at the little display on my smartphone and I can't tell what the facial expression is on the emoji. I'd be one of those people a lot. I'd have to magnify the image to make that work. Great to have you with us on AirTalk, and I hope to see you. Coming up next month, we're going to do a very special event. Last time we did it was 2 years ago. It's an election cram session. In just an hour, we're going to take every single California ballot proposition, put them before a panel of experts from different places, different perspectives, and we're going to talk about what the ballot measures would do. That's all going to be done at our Crawford Family Forum here at KPCC Wednesday night, October 17th, 7 p.m. Make your reservation now before you fill out your mail-in ballot, before you go to your polling place in November. Wednesday night, October 17th. It's our second annual ballot proposition cram session right here at 89.3 KPCC, October 17th, 7 o'clock, RSVP, kpcc.org/in-person.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. Offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by October 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I hope you're having a wonderful day. I sure appreciate your being with us. Such a pleasure to have you spend time, whether you're listening on our KPCC app via kpcc.org or at 89.3. Coming up a little bit later, we'll talk about the array of flavors that have been introduced in everything from soft drinks to snack foods to candy to try and appeal to the increasingly diverse tastes of Americans who've come from around the world. I'm going to ask you for your favorite, a taste of a candy or a snack food or something that is very different than you might expect, that incorporates, for lack of a better term, what we call ethnic flavors or flavors that come from countries around the world. So we're going to talk about that a little bit later, but right now we turn our attention to a bill that was just signed by Governor Brown, first in the nation legislation, which requires that physicians who are on probation for violations of sexual conduct or drug use or drug prescribing have to disclose that to a prospective patient when the patient is making the appointment to be seen by the physician. Joining us from the Associated Press, reporter Sophia Bolag. Sophia, thank you for joining us. Share with us, first of all, about what are the specific categories here of offenses that need to be disclosed?
Basically, the bill would require that doctors who are placed on probation for wrongdoing that has caused patients harm, including sexual misconduct, drug abuse, some criminal convictions, inappropriate prescribing of pharmaceuticals. Those are the types of things that if a doctor is placed on probation for one of those offenses, they would have to tell patients that they are on probation.
So once they're off the probation, once they've served that period, did they still have to disclose that at one time they went on probation for this, or do they no longer have to disclose at that point?
So the law applies to doctors who are currently on probation. It'll apply to doctors who are placed on probation after July 1st of next year. And so those are the people who would have to tell patients.
And if a physician was convicted of some offense in the past, they had you know, served out whatever the sentence is, and they still had their license to practice medicine, I don't know how common that is, but would they, for the rest of their professional career, have to disclose that, let's say, they had a conviction for a drug offense or something like that?
That seems to be a bit outside of the scope of this bill, which really just applies to doctors who are currently on probation in terms of disclosure requirements. Other than that, it's a bit outside the scope of my reporting, but this bill would apply in cases where, you know, for example, maybe a doctor was found to have committed some type of sexual misconduct with a patient and was therefore placed on probation as a result.
All right. We're talking with the Associated Press's Sophia Bolag. Also with us, Jamie Cord of Consumer Watchdog. He's president of the organization that strongly advocated for passage of this bill. Jamie, good to have you with us again. Do you think that this is going to have a significant effect on the ability of physicians on probation to attract patients?
No. I mean, I think this is just a common sense type measure. I mean, we have 140,000 physicians in the state. You know, we've got, probably 140 on probation at a given time. And so, and they're not all on probation for drug overprescribing or sexual misconduct or a self-abuse of drugs and alcohol. And so I think this is really just a good kind of informed consent for the consumer. Basically, if you're going to, you know, if you're going to have your daughter or you're going to go to a gynecologist, you want to know if they're on probation for sexually harassing a patient. If you're going to go under the knife and go to a surgeon, you're going to want to know if he has a history of drug abuse. And what powered this reform through after 3 years of trying by Senator Jerry Hill from the Bay Area was really the Me Too movement and the allegations against Larry Nassar, the Olympic physician, and the physician in Michigan. And many of the Olympians came forward, they came to Sacramento, and they said, look, so many of our sisters and brothers have been abused, and this would, if you have one doctor who's got thousands of patients, they would be forewarned. And that's what this really is. It's a deterrent. And by the way, I watched the medical board. You don't get put on probation just because you got drunk and got a DWI. I mean, most of the doctors on probation really are at risk of losing their license, and they plea bargain down. These are really serious offenses.
Okay.
By the way, 30% of the doctors who are on probation have a repeat offense. So it's a pretty serious issue.
We're talking with Jamie Cord of Consumer Watchdog. I'd love to hear from you as an AirTalk listener. If you're a physician, I'd like to hear your thoughts about this. Do you see this as a positive? Do you have concerns about it? We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. There is no other law like this in the country that I'm aware of. Are you concerned about any unintentional consequences, or do you think that this is just a an appropriate warning, putting this out there openly so people don't have to hunt it down on the State of California Medical Board website? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jamie, I don't understand how this applies to the Nassar case, because he wasn't on probation, right? So how does this have anything to do with that case?
Well, it's just that why the medical association had opposed this for 3 years, and the Olympians who were abused by Nassar came forward and said, look, it wouldn't have helped us. It absolutely wouldn't have. However, for others who are abused by doctors, and, you know, there are doctors on probation who continue the practice. There were, a significant number of sexual misconduct cases, maybe about 13% of the doctors in 2 years ago who were on probation were for sexual misconduct. If their patients had known, maybe they wouldn't have gone to that doctor. Maybe they would have been forewarned. So it was really just the power of their testimony to say, you don't realize how difficult it is for a patient to have that trust abused, particularly when you're young. And they came forward and just kind of gave, I think, the legislature a wake-up call about what it does to your life, how it ruins your life, and why, if we do have the knowledge that a doctor's been on probation because of sexual abuse, and that the public really does need that information. It broke the logjam in the legislature.
We reached out to the California Medical Association, haven't heard back from them, to hear their perspective on this. But our phone lines are open for you at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. TamCam writes on the page, if this law had been in place 7 years ago, it would have saved me a lot of anguish. Now we need a law against doctors requiring patients to sign agreements that you will not report them to the medical board or post negative comments about them. TamCam, I don't see how a physician could legally require that. Jamie, have you ever heard of that?
No, that is illegal.
That's illegal. You can't. Yeah, there's no. I can't imagine. First of all, a physician asking. I mean, that's just blatantly illegal. And that any patient would sign that you will not report them to the medical board if they engage in gross malfeasance. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jamie, you mentioned that these are egregious cases which put someone on probation, but nonetheless, probation is still the medical board saying that this physician is competent to practice, that we don't believe that the physician is a threat to patient safety. That's why we're allowing the physician to continue to practice, but under some degree of scrutiny and supervision. So if the medical board is essentially saying we're not revoking the license or suspending the license, instead it's probation, is there really a threat to the patient?
You know, just watching this, you know, for the last 20 years, we've talked about this on and on. The medical board is not a robust regulator, and it's been, I mean, it's been caught by 60 Minutes, the California Highway Patrol, lots of agencies, and not doing a great and good enough job. Really, if you get on probation, the way it works is doctors really have a lot of lawyers. They fight back against these charges. You've already had an allegation against you, and the allegation probably is that you're not fit to practice medicine. They plea bargain down. And they get a second chance. And so in the context of probation, it's not like being on, you know, the suspension list in high school. You have had to commit a harm to a patient. You have had to put someone's, you know, violate a canon of medical conduct. And, or, you know, overprescribing a certain canon of medical conduct, sexual misconduct. Also, if you have a criminal conviction that involves patient harm, you're supposed to tell patients under this law. You didn't have to do that previously. So if you look at the types of cases, I had a woman we work with who fought for this bill. Her son died. It was an overdose case. And he went into rehab, and the doctor in rehab overdosed him, and they won their malpractice case. This doctor did not lose his license. This doctor plea bargained down the probation, even though the medical board tried to take his license. Finally, they settled for a lesser charge, and that's how most of these cases are. So these are serious cases. If your doctor's on probation for any of these offenses, you should take that seriously. You should ask them about it. And most importantly, this is really a deterrent so that doctors are a little bit more careful about what they do, because this is a big red flag and a black mark on their record, and it should be.
Let me take a hypothetical, Jamie. So let's say you have a physician who's developed some sort of a substance abuse problem. It's not uncommon with doctors, like any profession. But doctors also have access to medications a greater degree than the general public. So let's say you have a physician who's become addicted to a substance, and on multiple occasions, the physician has shown up under the influence. This leads to a probationary period for the physician. Once that physician comes off probation, the medical board would be satisfied, let's say that the physician's gone through rehab and become sober. Do patients still get notified that the physician had a substance problem earlier or not?
No, only when they're on probation. This is only for doctors when they're on probation. If they come off probation, then they don't have to disclose anything to the patients. You know, obviously, if you have 30% of the doctors who are on probation having another offense, you have that kind of recidivist activity. This would probably be a very good deterrent for someone on probation never to have to do it again, because it is hard to give your patient that type of disclosure, assuming they actually see it and know, because they could bury this in some of the paperwork during your office visit. There is a written disclosure element to this. So I think the reality is these types of offenses jumped out at the legislature. What's not in the bill, by the way, Larry, is the top offense for which doctors are put on probation: gross negligence/incompetence, which is just a little bit higher than inappropriate prescribing in most years. Those offenses are not disclosed to patients. It's okay. Only the ones involving the other misconduct. So
okay.
We still have a ways to go to get full disclosure.
Okay. Also wanted to ask, what is the typical period of probation that we're talking about? Because if you know, depending on the length of it, this could wipe out a physician's practice if people avoid the physician. How long are we talking about?
Well, it depends on the offense, but it's usually, for instance, for overprescribing or for self-abuse with drugs, it'd be a year or two. And also after they get out of it, oftentimes there's self-abusive medication, there's often a testing, you know, as part of the stipulation with the probation is that they have to be tested for a period thereafter. To make sure they're not.
Yeah. Are there any other states you're aware of, Jamie, that are pursuing similar legislation?
No, but I think they will now. We're the first, and we're hopefully leading the way.
All right, Jamie, thanks so much. President Consumer Watchdog Jamie Court with us on Air Talk. My thanks to AP reporter Sophia Bolag, who wrote about California's first-in-the-nation legislation requiring doctors on probation for specific sexual misconduct or substance abuse or prescribing problems. They'd have to disclose that to prospective patients or current patients when they call to make an appointment. Share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Coming up, we're going to have fun with some of the new sorts of snack foods, candies that bring in specialty regional flavors into their products here in the U.S. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. I'm sure you've seen them, all the different snack foods on the shelf that bring in a variety of international flavors. Frito-Lay has been one of the companies that's done this a lot with their snack foods. They have flavors of Lay's potato chips that include Brazilian picanha, Chinese Szechuan chicken that they're going to be trying out, Greek tzatziki, an Indian tikka masala. So you've got all these different flavors in snack food. And then you've got M&M's that is planning to introduce three new peanut-based flavors for M&M's, including jalapeno and Thai coconut peanut. So my question for you as an Air Talk listener, is there a favorite of these international flavors that you found in a particular snack food or a candy or something that, you know, traditionally has been one way, like an M&M, you know, for I don't know, a century or whatever, an M&M has been plain or peanut. Or the American, you know, potato chip that was popularized. You have a favorite for an international flavor that's been included. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Joining me is John Stanton, professor of food marketing at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. He's also on the board of the Frankfurt Candy Company, which is best known for making the original chocolate Easter Bunny. John Stanton, thank you for joining us on Air Talk. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Larry.
So this trend toward bringing, you know, global flavors into the market, are there particular success stories that are, you know, just really shown the profit potential?
Well, I think it's probably too early to you know, to judge winners and losers. But what we know is that the American consumers are much more aware of international tastes and flavors. We've traveled more, and these food companies are taking advantage of the fact that Americans are being more open to different flavors.
Mm-hmm. Also with us, Jason Liebig, who is a food historian, a candy collector, and author of a blog, Collecting Candy, that documents candy packaging, marketing, and history. Also hosted the Cooking Channel's Food Flashback program. Jason, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Larry. Thanks.
Do you have a particular success story of an international flavor coming into a classic brand?
Well, I think if I was going to point to anything, I would point to the Latin-inspired, the sort of spicy flavors coming to American products and our sort of embracing of spice, which was traditionally not that much of an American flavor, but very much Latin. And I suppose if I was going to point to any big success, I would point to fiery Cheetos, because people are insane
yes.
for fiery Cheetos. They fill a very unique sort of pop cultural place in people's palates.
Yeah, I was waiting for someone to say the fiery Cheetos, because that to me is, because that's really become ubiquitous, not just in neighborhoods that are racially and ethnically diverse. You find those, you know, in middle America.
Oh, everywhere. Yeah, people of all places and types and shapes and sizes love them. Yeah, it's crazy.
The Flamin' Hot Cheetos phenomenon. All right, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Roberto in Pasadena said in Egypt they have Lay's ketchup chips. He's only seen them once or twice in the U.S., but he keeps his eye out for them because he says they're terrific. That's Roberto in Pasadena. I'd like to hear your favorite, whether it's a candy, a snack food, a chip that brings some sort of international flavor into it. And it could be at a specialty market, something that, you know, maybe you'd only find, say, in an Armenian neighborhood or in a Greek neighborhood. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Jason, in the history of candy, how open have candy makers been to bringing in global influences?
Well, I think it's a relatively recent. I think if you look, like people like Mars, they always took inspiration from other Western countries. Some people say Mars got the idea of M&M's because of Smarties, which were released by a company called Roundtree over there in the UK. But I would say this is a relatively recent phenomena, and you see it. Because you see people, because of social media, because of the internet, becoming, like you said, becoming aware of these things. You've got things like the matcha green tea Kit Kat in Japan, a place where they've probably had over 100 different flavors of Kit Kat released over the years. So those start getting imported to, you know, to Chinese food or Japanese food and Korean markets. So people here are trying them. People are ordering them offline. And you've got a real embracing, as John said, a real embracing and awareness of global flavors and just, in my opinion, a desire to experience more flavors. I think snack and candy has moved. I wouldn't say it's changed, but I'd say it's expanded. And now people go to those things, those categories, to have an experiential entertainment experience.
And I understand you've tried wasabi cream Oreos that are sold in Asia. How was the wasabi cream Oreo?
Yeah, Nabisco in China and Hong Kong just released hot chicken wing cream Oreos and wasabi flavored cream Oreos. They came out about 3 weeks ago. Once I found out, of course, I was online ordering boxes of them to try. And they are, well, how would I put this? They are what you would expect. I can say this. I've had people dislike both of them. I was not the hugest fan, although I've had people really like the wasabi flavor cream. But everyone sort of agrees that the chicken wing, the hot chicken wing cream is probably not something they're going to dip in milk anytime soon.
Nestle has spicy nerds, I understand, which I'd love that expression, spicy nerds. It's an oxymoron, right?
That is funny.
Yeah, they've got guava and mango chili nerds. Yeah, they've got great. They released a whole series of, like, their Laffy Taffy. They released a sort of Latin-inspired flavors for nerds, for Laffy Taffy, and even Pixie Sticks, where they would have those flavors in there, which is pretty great.
Jason Liebig with us, food historian and candy collector, author of the blog Collecting Candy, and host of the cooking channel show Food Flashback. John Stanton, professor, St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. He's professor of food marketing. Professor, how do these companies, you know, what sort of market research do they do to really try and determine that a flavor is worth putting into production?
Well, I'll tell you, things have changed, and I agree with Jason in terms of they can really begin to target specific markets. For example, if they think something is going to be popular with the Hispanic market, boy, they have TV shows, they have social media, they have ways that they can just deliver that message to the people that they think are going to be the best consumers for this. Now, the nice thing about candy is it's not that much of a changeover. A company like Frito-Lay can put a flavor out on the market, and if it doesn't sell well, they can drop it, replace it with another one at really minimal expense. It's not like trying to figure out, you know, buying a car, and if a car model fails, they've lost billions of dollars. And that's not the case with these snacks. So you really have the combination of the ability to target the relative inexpensive of changeover, and this sense that Americans are just, their palate is just open to more and more exotic tastes and flavors.
And I wonder if their thinking is, John, that it doesn't even have to be a huge seller, but having variety, making people look at the shelf a little longer to see that there's another option that might pique people's interest, even if they don't necessarily buy at that time, that obviously they don't want to lose money. But is there sort of an interest factor here that they're trying to get to?
We call that a halo effect, that, you know, maybe this really strange flavor pulls you in to take a look at the shelf, and lo and behold, your eyes look at some of these other things. It's really an essential part of brand building. And we don't, and I know Jason would agree with this, being a candy collector, candy's supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be, you know, something that you can have some emotional attachment to. If you buy a flavor and you don't really like it, okay, the heck with it. It's not like you've made it a Thanksgiving meal and people say, I don't like turkey.
Yeah. Right. Kim writes on the Air Talk page, I saw shamrock and sour cream potato chips in Ireland. I didn't get a chance to taste them, Kim writes. I wish I had. What does a shamrock taste like? That's a very good question, Kim. Now, I would have thought maybe Guinness and sour cream or something. I'm not sure they'd go together. Let's see. We have Grant, who writes on the page, Tapatio Doritos. They are the best.
Yeah.
Let's see. We have Mejid in Santa Monica says, my favorite snack flavor is Peruvian corn nuts. I like the crunchiness of it. That sounds interesting. Peruvian corn nuts. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org, to let us know what your favorite is of new generations of internationally influenced snack foods, of candies. What about the import market, Jason, for candies? I know a lot of candy comes from Mexico, for example, because we have so many people who've emigrated from Mexico that want the taste of home. But are a lot of other countries major exporters of candy to the U.S.?
No, none is big. I mean, what you have are, you've sort of got walled off territories. A company like Cadbury, who at times in the past 50 years ago might have tried to distribute their own products here, in the early 70s, signed licensing agreements with Hershey. So now anything branded Cadbury in the United States is actually being manufactured by Hershey. Kit Kat was not an original, well, it's a Nestle product now, but in the United States, it's Hershey. So you don't see as much of that coming into the United States. And partially it is because of trademark laws and these sort of walled off territories. To your question, though, what you do see a lot more of, and I think this speaks to everything that John and you've and I've been talking about, is you see the hunger for it. You see subscription boxes that will literally give you candies and snacks of the world, and people get these every month, and
really?
They'll pay a subscription fee. Yes. So you get that. You get people getting treats from Southeast Asia and ordering them over because the flavors are so exotic and interesting, and they just want to try them. They want to experience that thing.
So interesting.
Be it shamrock flavored Lay's chips.
It makes me want to go, you know, find a shamrock to taste. Hey, quickly before we conclude, John Stanton of St. Joseph's University, how targeted specifically to stores are these products, particularly by a huge company like Frito-Lay?
Well, the ability to use this, what's called the data analytics, is just incredible. So they can literally put together a category because you have this direct store delivery. You have these Frito-Lay trucks pulling up in front of the supermarket, and they're deciding what goes on the shelf. And they can put a plan together for each individual store based on who are the customers of that store. And again, this is partly why we're seeing, you know, even if you wanted to do this 25 years ago, you probably couldn't do it. You wouldn't have the ability to decide which markets really will buy the product, and you would have no way to communicate specifically to those people. So we're looking at a phenomena that's taking place because a lot of things are becoming possible today that wasn't possible a few years ago. But you could actually do and store by store set.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And targeted that closely. Gentlemen, I want to thank you. This has been a lot of fun. That's John Stanton, professor of food marketing, St. Joe's University in Philadelphia. He's on the board, by the way, of the Frankfurt Candy Company, best known for the original chocolate Easter Bunny. And my thanks to Jason Liebig, food historian, candy collector, his blog, Collecting Candy. Also wanted to mention that we have a listener, Ashley, I believe, in Riverside, says the Kettle Chip brand that it's Korean barbecue flavors. That's her favorite. You can share your favorite on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Coming up, we reconvene the Triple Play. A. Martinez, Nick Roman, and me talk Dodger baseball with you. The Dodgers come off a sweep with their rivals for the Western Division title. We'll be back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle, and I so look forward to having my colleagues join me for our talk about Dodger baseball. We call ourselves the Triple Play. Nick Roman of All Things Considered, A. Martinez of Take Two joining me. And we're going to talk about the Dodgers. It seems like every time we've come together, the team has played better right immediately following. Although this time, I hope we don't break up the streak because the Dodgers are coming off a sweep of the team that they're in a dogfight with to win the National League West, the Colorado Rockies. Day off for the Dodgers today. They open a series with the Padres at Dodger Stadium tomorrow night. So, A, how heartened are you by the performance?
Well, you know that on my business card, Larry, it says host of Take Two, Dodger pessimist. I will always be a Dodger pessimist. And here's the reason why. We saw it a little bit last year. We've seen it a little bit this year in that they are the league leaders in losing focus. They do it better than any other Major League Baseball team. And I'll give you a recent example, too. They were playing really well a couple of weeks back. They played the Mets. Now, the Mets have a pretty good pitching staff, but they still should have beaten. They lost 2 of 3.
The didn't next they week, beat the game? They won the game DeGrom pitched,
yes,
though, didn't they?
Yeah, right. Their the best one, pitcher. Yeah. But then the week after that, they go to Cincinnati, a terrible team, and drop 2 of 3. And then they play really well against the Rockies as they just swept them. So I fully expect them this weekend, Larry, to lose focus and lose 2 of 3, if not get swept by the Padres.
I heard you guys on the break just before Air Talk began, and I felt so sad. I drove off the freeway and I bought some baseball cards because they always make me feel happy.
Oh, you did! Hey, thanks, Nick.
And
it is great. And Topps baseball.
And I thought, you know, maybe they'll pick up a Dodger or two in a pack, and they'll feel happy. Because I already feel happy. There. In fact, I bought myself 4 packs, so you know I already feel good about all of this.
All right,
I got a giant already in here. Look at this. Look at the bad luck I'm getting already.
I did too. I got Tony Watson.
Well, look, Cody Bellinger. Yeah, I got Cody Bellinger.
There you go. So the thing is that this Dodger team right now is playing better in September than all the other Dodger teams, the 5 earlier ones that had won the division. Their September record is terrific. It's better than the one last year. They're playing great. They would have to absolutely collapse, and I don't think that's going to happen. They got 9 games left. Kershaw and Walker Buehler are going to pitch 4 of those 9 if they're needed. And the teams that they're playing are not as tough as the teams that Colorado's playing. So, really, I feel really good right now.
All right. Well, let's take your assumption that the Dodgers are poised to win the division.
Yeah.
And we don't know who they necessarily be playing, but
It would definitely be the Atlanta Braves.
Yeah, that's what it's
because
looking like, yeah.
Because the best record in the league is held by the Chicago Cubs
right now. So it would have to be the Dodgers would have to catch, you know, end up with the best record, and then they'd play the wild card team. I'm actually okay with them playing the Braves.
Yeah, though, they could beat the Braves. Yeah. I guess my concern is twofold, but the biggest one being still the bullpen and the fact the Dodgers have had a difficult time holding leads. Kenley Jansen is not the Kenley Jansen that we have seen over the past several years. A, what's your feeling about their pitching?
Well, the other part of it, too, is that they're going to rely on Kenta Maeda to just duplicate some of that great postseason success he had. Now, they're asking him to do it a lot earlier than last season, so you got to also wonder about how that's going to affect him in the postseason, considering he had to just completely change everything about how he prepares for a start week to week, as he always does. And then, yeah, with Kenley Jansen not being such a slam dunk, Nick, as before, it kind of worries me, because if he blows a game in the playoffs, do you go back to him the next night?
Yeah. Well, that I understand all those concerns. And again, I'm not that worried, because he's pitching better now than he did when he had that, you know, the heart thing that happened in Colorado. True. And Kenta Maeda, the last two nights, was fabulous. Just
fabulous. Do you notice
fabulous.
How different he looks, like his facial expression?
Yeah.
He doesn't even look like, because when he's starting pitching, he always looks so kind of laid back on the mound, relaxed.
You got to stretch it out.
Yeah. But when he comes in, he looks so intense as a relief pitcher. I can't believe the change in demeanor.
So, you know, they not only have him, but then Scott Alexander is pitching much better out of the bullpen. The lefty they got from Kansas City in the offseason. And then my favorite guy, which is Caleb Ferguson. I call him 1149 because he was the 1,149th guy drafted that year. And he has just no conscience. He just throws rockets the whole time. And I'm feeling, like I say, I'm feeling really good. Dylan Floro looks good. I think this is a very strong bullpen.
I don't like
now.
This upbeat Nick Roman.
Yeah.
I don't like this.
Floro's stuff. Did you see his stuff when he came in? Was it last night's game or the night before? I can't remember when Floro came in, but his stuff was great.
Yeah,
that
it was
ball,
really good.
That
all those
ball
guys,
was moving all over the place. I very, very tough to hit, although he hasn't always been in when he's been brought in. What is it that Pedro Baez has on Dodger management? What does he know about them that enables him to leverage all the usage he gets?
I think that they like the fact that he throws really hard, but that takes you only so long, and perhaps this is the season that it all runs out.
The other part of it too, and this is just me speculating on what I think might be behind this, Larry, is that it has to do a little with front office ego. They've put their trust in him. It works sometimes, it doesn't work other times, and I think they want to prove that their decision-making ability on Pedro Baez is correct and that he will prove them right. That has to be the reason.
That could be. I think he's seen some nefarious activity and he knows something and holding it over there. We're talking on the triple play, A. Martinez, Nick Roman, and me, Larry Mantle, the three of us weighing in on the Dodgers. I'd like to hear what you think. Are you an optimist or a pessimist about the Dodgers? How do you analyze this team's chances, first, to win the Western Division, secondly, to go very far in the playoffs? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. We look forward to hearing what you have to say about this Dodgers team. One thing that kind of stood out to me, and this is a complaint. I'm not alone in having this. Many of my colleagues, you may have even brought this up to me in our conversations. The unwillingness of the Dodgers to really play into the hot player. Baseball's a game of streaks, as we all know. The Dodgers seem very resistant to riding the hot hand. And Dave Roberts the other night said something in an interview which really shocked me. And he said, well, we don't put as much, I'm paraphrasing, we don't put as much stock in when someone's hot as their overall performance over time. We like the larger sample. Now, I took statistics a long time ago in college, so I may be totally off base here. But the issue wouldn't be the larger sample size necessarily that would tell you how that hot player would do in a game that night. Wouldn't it be how they've done before, how long their hot streaks have gone, not what their overall performance is?
Well, it has to do with how, with this way of thinking, momentum is something that does not exist. It cannot exist in a statistics-based environment, because then you're putting stock into forces that can't be quantified, that can't be added up, subtracted, multiplied, or divided on. So that's why they don't do that. And it also has to do with gut instinct. And that's also something that the Dodgers and many other teams in Major League Baseball have decided they don't want to do because that was the old way of doing things. And the old way isn't necessarily the best way.
Although I have seen them fiddle with that a little bit. They started stealing bases, for example, much more than they had earlier in the season. There was a little bit more daring with bunting, which has sometimes worked and sometimes hasn't worked. And I also think that the bigger sample works when you're looking at hitters. I'm not sure it works with pitchers, and I think they're willing to adjust their thinking about pitchers in that regard.
And I'm still skeptical, even with hitters, because of the. I understand overall, but when you've got a player in a hot streak, I don't understand why you don't ride him.
And generally, they're correct because if you think of the Major League Baseball season, we've all heard it be described as a marathon, 162 games. The problem is that the playoffs is a sprint. So if you're going to be a marathon runner for 6 months and then all of a sudden have to become a sprinter for a week, you have to run really fast to change yourself.
Yeah. All right, I've got a break, but Gilmore13 tweets at Air Talk, your casual dismissal of the Braves just cost you a donation in the member Gilmore.
I'm serious. I'm sorry about that.
Nick, all right. So, Gilmore, you got to tell us what you normally contribute. Nick will have to make it up.
All right.
Take a cut in the All Things Considered budget. We'll continue. The Triple Play, talking about the Dodgers, 866-893-KPECC. You're listening to Air Talk. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. All the heavy news going on in the world. We like to take every few weeks a chance to bring the guys together, talk Dodger baseball, Nick Roman, A. Martinez, Larry Mantle, and I'd love to hear from you. And I don't just mean guys, KPCC, Air Talk, women fans of the Dodgers, too. Let's get some gender diversity with your calls about the team, 866-893-KPCC, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. And we've already offended Gilmore 13.
Can I win his membership back again?
No.
Here's the thing.
I did not want the Dodgers to face the Braves in a one-game playoff because they would throw Mike Foltynewicz probably, and he's a really good pitcher with the Braves. I am more willing to see the Dodgers take on the Braves in the playoffs, partly because they beat them a few years ago, although the teams are much different than they were back then. But please don't take that money away.
Sounding like a politician. It's already election season here, apparently.
I thought you were going to stand on your principles and fill that gap. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Rigo in Anaheim says Dave Roberts should be fired. If they keep switching the lineup, the Dodgers are going to lose because baseball is about playing the hot hand. The whole Dave Roberts, as his contract, I guess, is up at the end of the year. The team holds a 1 year option beyond.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
The question is he going to be back if the Dodgers don't make the playoffs or if they go out in the first in the divisional playoff series? It's still unclear to me how much control Roberts has of the lineup. Do you have a sense of that?
He doesn't. It's all predetermined. In terms of what Andrew Freeman, what Farhan Zaidi, the two guys in charge of the Dodgers, want him to do. And I think for him, when they're judging him, it won't be necessarily on what happens on the field, whether they win the World Series or not. It'll be how good of a job he has done in translating their vision to the players, getting them to buy in, and then not deviating from the script. There's a lot of temptation a lot of times for managers to just go with their gut. Tommy Lasorda, that's what he did, went with his gut, but he was a different era. He has done a really good job of taking that vision, making the players buy in, even though sometimes they don't like sitting out from time to time when they have the hot hand, and then just getting these players to understand that this is how things are going to be. I mean, that's exactly how he should be judged if you're looking through the eyes of Andrew Freeman and Farhan Zaidi.
Well, and his success is you can't deny it. I mean, they've been in the 3 years now that he's been manager, two of them, they went to the National League Champion Series, and one of them they went to the World Series. So the team is, where it was supposed to be all along. And you don't
think they've underperformed this year?
Well, they have because there are reasons for it. I mean, you lose here's another stat for you. When Justin Turner starts a game, for the Dodgers, their winning percentage is about what it was last year. When he doesn't start, they have a losing record, and he was out for 40 games at the start of the season. They haven't had Corey Seager, an all-star shortstop, for the entire season.
But they did all right replacing him.
They absolutely did. But you know, who could have predicted in spring training that there would be some games where you would have David Freese at first base and Dozier at second and Machado at third and Max
Muncy in the lineup.
And Max Muncy in the lineup. You never would have predicted any of that. So if there was underperforming, it hasn't been since that game in Miami, when they remember they lost the first two games in that series long ago, and then they beat Miami, then they went to Washington and they took those guys out. From that moment on, the Dodgers have had the best record in the National League. So things are about where I think they expected them to be, and they're playing great in September, which is when you really have to play great.
All right, Nick Roman of All Things Considered, A. Martinez Take Two, Larry Mantle with you, the Triple Play, talking Dodger baseball. You want to weigh in with your thoughts about the Dodgers? How well poised are they for the playoffs? Should they make the playoffs? Well, we have nine games left to go. And a 2.5-game lead over the Colorado Rockies. So decent shape. By no means clinched. 866-893-KPCC. So, Nick, it sounds like you're saying essentially, and I think, A, you're subscribing to this too, that the job of Dave Roberts, the manager, is essentially player relations, sort of make them feel okay, help motivate them, make people feel good about it. That's really, and then sort of be the PR person, you know, talk to reporters, be the guy who does the twice a day reporter brief. Is that pretty much his job?
They don't manage a game as much as they manage that clubhouse. They manage what happens
and
in
press.
That clubhouse, right? And then make sure that the players don't kill each other because they don't like what maybe management wants them to do. And that's exactly what he's there to do: put out those fires.
And of course, there's a whole lot of help because you have a ton of guys, former general managers in the front office. Each team has a bench coach, somebody who's experienced and has been a manager on another team. There's a lot of help, and it's a more sort of corporatizing of baseball. It may not be as romantic, but it seems to be working.
John Curtis tweets at AirTalk, guys, the baseball card thing gave me a lot of joy. I want to know, though, who got what? Who got Cody Bellinger? Was that you?
I got Cody Bellinger and Mike Trout, too.
Man.
I got Mike Trout. I think I won.
But you got a Giant.
Whatever
so
I want.
Detracts.
Well, yeah, I put him at the bottom of the pile now.
I got Garrett Cole and Joey Votto, and that other pack that I bought at the store, I did get Justin Turner.
Yeah, I got Cole. I got Tony Watson of the Giants, Scott Kingery of the Phillies, Joey Votto. I got two Scott. Did I get two Scott Kingery?
Did you get two of them?
No, I guess just one. Okay.
I'll give you a Minnesota Twins team card for that one.
Oh, gee, thank you. Jason Hamill of the Royals, Justin Bour of the Marlins. So those are a few of the ones.
Yeah.
I got a local kid here, Lucas Giolito from the White Sox, played at Harvard Westlake.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
In Studio City, the high school.
Yeah, they're,
I got I got an ex-Dodger, Ronald Torres, who's actually a very versatile player for the Yankees now, and I kind of wish the Dodgers had held on to him.
Did anybody get Pedro Baez by any
chance? No.
Hard.
No. Burned my hand. It was so hard. Diane in Palm Springs says, I'm a Lady Giants fan, she says, but I will still make a donation to KPCC.
There you go.
Diane, bless you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Hey, guys, it's been fun. So we'll come back before the end of the season, right?
I hope so.
I know only 9 games left. We're either going to come back and commiserate if the news is bad, which you assure us it won't be, Nick.
It will not be.
Or to preview the playoffs. Okay, that's to come. All right.
Pencil it in.
Nick Roman, A. Martinez, Larry Mantle. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next. Maggie Gyllenhaal is going to talk about her very interesting role in the HBO series The Deuce. If you haven't seen this series, she's got a terrific character. She's going to talk all about it with Terry coming up on Fresh Air. Have a great afternoon. Back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for Air Talk, and then, of course, Film Week at 11 o'clock tomorrow.